You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending October 10th. I'm Joe Elia. We try to capture the week's essential medical news, the information you want to take with you into next week, and then we offer an interview. This week's interview is about the benefits of having end-of-life conversations with your patients. If you'd like to leave us a comment, or even a rant, call 617-440-4374. Links for everything are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. All right, here are the week's medical headlines. End-of-life discussions, have them. Tiotropium relieves symptoms but doesn't change disease course in COPD. Colorectal cancer screening guidelines updated. And carotid stenting and endarterectomy give about the same longer-term results. And now for the details. For my money, the most intriguing story of the week concerns the value of end-of-life discussions. We'll talk more about that during the interview, coming right up. Next, tiotropium. In some 6,000 patients with moderate to severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, randomized to tiotropium or placebo and treated for about 4 years, tiotropium decreased exacerbations of the disease and improved quality of life. But it didn't stem the rates of decline in forced expiratory volume or improve mortality rates over those on placebo. Next, colorectal cancer screening. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has updated its 2002 recommendations. The task force recommends screening using newer, high-sensitivity fecal occult blood testing, sigmoidoscopy with interval fecal occult blood testing, or colonoscopy. It recommends against routine screening in people aged 76 to 85 who have had consistently negative screening since age 50, and it recommends against screening in those over age 85. Also, the task force finds that three screening regimens all provide equal life years gained benefits, although it doesn't make a recommendation on which to use. The first regimen is annual high-sensitivity fecal occult blood testing. The second, sigmoidoscopy every 5 years with high-sensitivity blood testing every 3. And the third, colonoscopy at 10-year intervals. Finally this week, the carotid arteries, stent or scrape. Two studies appearing in Lancet Neurology this month show that carotid stenting and endarterectomy have about equal benefit. Together, the studies comprise about 1,700 patients randomized to one of the two treatments. In Journal Watch General Medicine, Alan Brett writes, quoting, "Taken together, these trials suggest that stenting and endarterectomy afford equal protection against stroke in the long run, assuming that patients' initial procedures are uneventful. However, we still need a better understanding of which patients experience procedural complications and how to avoid them." That's the week's news. Here is the Journal Watch interview. Earlier this week, JAMA published a paper entitled "Associations Between End-of-Life Discussions, Patient Medical Health, Medical Care Near Death, and Caregiver Bereavement Adjustments." The paper concludes that end-of-life discussions produce less aggressive care in the patient's final week, possibly mitigate fear and depression near death, and help informal caregivers, relatives and friends, avoid long-term adverse effects like depression. Dr. Alexi Ann Wright, the paper's first author, has kindly agreed to discuss the implications of her work with us. She's a hematology-oncology fellow at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Wright.
My pleasure.
You studied some 330 pairs of patients and their informal caregivers, and you report that that only about a third of them had had these end-of-life discussions. Did that surprise you?
So this is an important question. We know from other studies that patients only remember about one-third of what physicians tell them in a doctor's office. And the way that this study was designed, we asked patients whether they remembered having these conversations, So I suspect that that is a very low estimate of the number of conversations that actually happen out in practice.
Do you think, though, that a conversation about the end of one's life would be as forgettable, say, as how often you should take aspirin?
No, you're absolutely right. I think that the conversations about the end of life can be very difficult, both for patients and for doctors. But there are certainly a subgroup of patients who don't want to have these conversations and may block them out, even when the physicians bring it up. We've looked at this with prognostic disclosures, when people say how long, when physicians tell a patient how long they think they have to live. And there again, when these conversations are tape recorded, we see that 70% of doctors bring this up and only about a third of patients remember it. The reality is, in a basic visit between an oncologist and a patient, there is a flood of information.
I see. So you think that your hypothesis is, and you don't test it in this paper, but your hypothesis is that more than a third of these patients had received, had a conversation with their physician, or at least their physician had told them that they were near death.
I think a third of patients had talked with their physicians about how long they had to, more than a third had talked with their physicians about how long they had to live. Whether they had discussed the end of life or not is hard to say, because talking about death is difficult. And in a sense, what motivated us to do this study in the first place was we wanted to see whether these conversations were worth it. You know, these conversations can be so difficult and upsetting that we wanted to see whether they actually improved patients' quality of life and their medical care at the end of life.
And what got you interested in the problem? Was there an episode in your training that made this compelling?
I think there were a number of times when I saw patients bring up how long they had to live with their physicians. And I saw wonderful doctors suddenly communicate incredibly euphemistically. So doctors would often clam up or give very vague answers. And I had a number of family members contact me after their loved ones die and say, "What happened? I had no idea that this was about to happen." And it was really answering to them and trying to figure out whether these conversations were worth it again that motivated this research.
In some of the literature that you cite, there I was noticing the word complicit in the title. So in some ways, do you think that a physician can be complicit with a patient in not discussing this, in seeming to discuss the end of life, but not really discussing it for fear of either damage to the patient's feelings or the general discomfort of the conversation?
I think it happens all the time. I think there's an elaborate dance that physicians and patients do towards the end of life. Neither doctors or patients want to face limitations of medical care, nor our own mortality. And so the reality is, some physicians argue that you can actually do harm to patients by having these conversations. And that, I think it's that concern of robbing patients of hope or upsetting them at a time when they're already highly vulnerable that makes people, you know, really clam up around these conversations.
And your research found, though, that to the contrary, there was more benefit than harm coming from those conversations.
That's absolutely right. And it was a big surprise because we expected to find more evidence of psychological harm associated with these conversations. You know, what motivated this was the question of, is this bitter pill of discussing the end of life really worth it? And much to our surprise, we didn't find any evidence that end-of-life discussions were associated with higher rates of depression or worry.
And actually, there are other benefits as well. I mean, as without enumerating all of them, I think you found that, first of all, people who had these conversations with their physicians had less aggressive care at the end of life, and people who had less aggressive care had a better quality of life in the final week of life. Is that right?
Right. Those results were striking to me because previously I thought, okay, so maybe they get slightly less aggressive care, but we found that patients were 3 times less likely to be admitted to the intensive care unit, 4 times less likely to be put on a ventilator, and 6 times less likely to undergo resuscitation in their final week of life. And that these things really mattered, that patients who got aggressive care in their final week of life had worse quality of life, and then perhaps even more important, their caregivers 6 months later had significantly worse quality of life. They were more likely to be depressed, more likely to say that their health was worse than it had been. And this is adjusting for the baseline rate of mental health disorders and health that they had long before, really at the entry of the study point.
It seems that planning for a good death is necessary work, which if you don't do it, can cause a lot of pain and regret later. So there is that work to be done. It's not something that you just fall into, luckily, it seems, but you got to plan for it.
I think that's true, and I think both sides need to plan for it, patients and doctors. It's important for cancer patients with advanced disease to talk with their doctors about the kind of medical care they want to receive at the end of their lives if they're ready, because their mental and physical health often deteriorates rapidly. And at that point, family members and their physicians are left holding the bag, trying to anticipate what their loved one would have wanted if only they could speak for themselves.
How did that relate to the length of time that people spent in hospice?
So patients who remembered having end-of-life conversations were much more likely to be referred to hospice early. And this is important because what we're finding nationally is a third of people are being referred to hospice with less than 1 week to live. And in our study, we show that patients who get referred with less than 1 week to live have no better quality of life than if they never received hospice at all. It really takes time to reap the benefits of getting hospice, to get the kind of tailored care to help patients have less pain, less suffering, less shortness of breath at the end of life, and also for their family members to have the kind of support that hospice provides. This, to me, was a very important point that actually hasn't been emphasized in the media because again, a third of people are being referred to hospice with less than a week to live, and we're finding in this paper that they're getting no benefit from that.
It seems almost as if that being admitted to hospice in the final week of life is another kind of bewildering, almost aggressive intervention.
I think that's right. It's introducing a new care team right at the end. Families have to get used to people being in their home. They don't have time to form relationships, let alone take care of all the basic things like getting equipment, getting medications. Bringing in hospice at the final hour of life may actually, although we didn't find it in this study, it may actually be traumatic to families rather than helpful, even though people have the best intentions bringing hospice in.
So, Alexi, what's your next project?
So the next thing we're going to do is move into the intensive care unit and look at what, really try to pinpoint which medical interventions are the ones that are associated with distress for patients and their family members. That, and we're also going to study the end-of-life conversations themselves and try to figure out if there's a way to predictably identify which patients don't want to have these conversations or might potentially even be harmed. Because although we found no harm in this study, we know from clinical experience that there are patients who are upset by these conversations. And if we can spare them, the ones that are not only upset but might not have a benefit from the conversations, if we can spare them that trauma, then that's a worthwhile endeavor.
In the meantime, what would you hope that a physician with a dying patient would do as a result of having read your study?
I would hope that they wouldn't shy away from talking about the end, that physicians would try to ask their patients what kind of care they want to receive at the end of their life, so that patients have a chance to prepare for death, to say the goodbyes to their families that they want to, and to die in the way that they want to. We know that most people want to die at home, and yet almost 50% of Americans die in the hospital. We need to give patients a chance to really live their final days the way that they want to.
are there resources that physicians can go to have strategies about, or to have strategies about how to initiate these conversations?
That's a great question. I think that there are courses that physicians can take that help improve their communication skills. There's something called OncoTalk, designed specifically for oncologists, and there are some palliative care courses. But I'm not aware of any resources at present that really walk a physician through best practices for having an end-of-life conversation. I haven't been able to find really any legitimate research-based approach to end-of-life, the best practices for end-of-life conversation.
You may have to establish those best practices yourself then.
I should be so lucky.
Well, we hope that you do. I want to thank you, Dr. Wright, for your time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Finally this week, after a long wait, the Nobel Committee awarded the prize in physiology or medicine for the discovery of the AIDS virus. Luc Montagnier and Françoise Barré-Sanoussi, the committee wrote, found the virus in 1983 and called it LAV, or lymphadenopathy-associated virus. Of course, we now call it HIV. There were other contenders, and for a long time it seemed that the work might never be recognized because of what seemed to be silly bickering and legalistic maneuverings between the Americans and the French. Thankfully, the Nobel Committee has settled that embarrassing episode. The committee itself deserves a kind of scientific peace prize. In addition, the discovery of the link between human papillomavirus and cervical cancer was also honored with the awarding of the Nobel to Harald Zurhausen, a prize-worthy name in itself. We offer our congratulations and wishes for more discoveries, and soon. If you'd like to comment on this week's podcast, call 617-440-4374. Links for all stories are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where you will also find a collection of previous editions. Join us next week, won't you? Thank you for listening. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.